MyAudiobooks.ai presents The Patch Returns, What a New Contraceptive Approval Says About 20 Years of Silence. In late July of 2026, the Food and Drug Administration approved a birth control patch. That sentence should not feel remarkable. Hormonal contraception has existed for over 60 years, and the agency approves generic and branded variants of it regularly. But it is. Guinlo, a once-weekly transdermal system from Viatris, delivering a low dose of estrogen, is the first new contraceptive patch to reach American pharmacies in roughly 2 decades. The approval arrived through the 505(b)(2) pathway on the strength of a phase 3 trial in more than 2,000 women, with an adhesion profile engineered to fix the exact problem, patches that detach, that helped sink the category's last entrant. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can listen to deep dive investigations like this one. Plus, create your own audiobooks from prompts and documents with a single subscription. The 2-decade gap is the story. And it is not a story about science. The pharmacology of transdermal contraception was largely settled in the 2000s. Skin is an excellent delivery route for steroid hormones. Steady absorption avoids the daily peaks and troughs of pills. And a weekly rhythm is easier to adhere to than a daily one. The gap is a story about what happens to a product category when its litigation history, its market dynamics, and its political weather all turn hostile at once, and about what it takes in 2026 to bet against that memory. One approval does not reverse a 20-year silence. But reading the approval closely, the dose, the body mass limit, the study design, the corporate lineage behind it, tells you where women's health innovation actually goes, and how slowly the sins of the last cycle are paid down. Section 1. The Patch That Came Before. To understand why this approval matters, you have to understand what happened to the first patch. In the early 2000s, a weekly contraceptive patch was launched as a breakthrough in convenience. No daily pill, no office procedure, pharmacy prescribed and self-applied. It worked. It also delivered meaningfully more estrogen than a standard pill, because transdermal delivery required a higher dose to achieve the same suppression of ovulation. And estrogen, in the crude arithmetic of thrombosis risk, is a dose-dependent hazard. A cascade of lawsuits followed, alleging the patch's clot risk exceeded the pills, and that the risk had not been adequately communicated. The maker settled the bulk of the litigation for well over $1 billion. The label grew progressively darker, and the product's commercial arc bent toward decline. Not because it was banned, and not because women rejected the concept, but because the combination of litigation cost, bad headlines, and a shrinking market made the category commercially radioactive. The lesson the industry took was not subtle. Contraception is used by millions of healthy young women for years at a time, which means the tolerance for any risk signal, real, exaggerated, or litigated, approaches zero, while the revenue per patient is modest. The result was a collapse in contraceptive innovation that lasted, by some counts, a decade and a half. The major manufacturers wound down development, the venture money went elsewhere, and the methods available in 2025 were, with a handful of exceptions, the methods available in 2010. The category did not die. It went dormant. A market of 40 million American women served by a frozen product menu, waiting for someone willing to try again. The thrombosis arithmetic behind that retreat is worth spelling out, because it explains the entire 2-decade design brief. Combined hormonal contraception works by suppressing ovulation with an estrogen and a progestin, and the estrogen, ethinyl estradiol, carries a dose-dependent risk of venous thromboembolism, the blood clots that can travel to the lungs and kill. The absolute risk is small in absolute terms, a few extra cases per 10,000 women per year on top of the background risk pregnancy itself creates. But the litigation calculus is not absolute. It is comparative and emotional. A healthy 22-year-old who dies of a pulmonary embolism is a jury's nightmare and a headline's dream. And the patch's higher exposure made the comparison to the pill indefensible in court, regardless of the epidemiology. The entire category's frozen state traces back to that asymmetry, a modest, dose-dependent clinical risk amplified by a zero-tolerance social context into a commercial extinction event. Section 2. What the new patch actually fixes. Read the approval specifics, and you can see the engineering answering the old failures line by line. The dose, 20 micrograms per day of ethanol estradiol, at the low end of the modern range and below the original patch's exposure, a deliberate retreat from the dose that made thrombosis lawyers wealthy. The delivery, norelgestromin, the same progestin as the old patch, chosen for familiarity and for the 505B2 pathway's reliance on prior findings, the regulatory equivalent of building on a foundation already inspected. The adhesion. The trial reported a full detachment rate around 1%, roughly a tenth of the rates that plagued the earlier generation, because a contraceptive that falls off in the shower is not a contraceptive. The label's most interesting line is the limit. Approved for women with a body mass index under 30, reflecting trial data and honest uncertainty about efficacy at higher weights, an admission the older era would have blurred, and a preview of the argument the launch will have to win. The efficacy number deserves the same honest read. A Pearl index around 4 pregnancies per 100 woman years. That is effective by historical standards, comparable to or better than typical use pills, where human error dominates. But it is not the near-perfect number the marketing will imply. And the gap between perfect use and typical use is precisely the gap the patch exists to close. The trial's real selling point is not chemical, it is behavioral. Adherence research has shown for decades that longer interval methods outperform daily ones in the real world, not because they are stronger, but because people are people. A weekly patch is a concession to human nature that no pill can match, and it is the quiet thesis behind the entire approval. At myaudiobooks.ai, we track the primary documents that shape women's health, approvals, labels, and the trial data beneath them. Narrated. Section 3. The Corporate Genetics. The approval also tells a quieter story about who makes contraception now. And the answer is not who you think. Viatris is not a research-driven biotech. It is the consolidation of generics and legacy brands. Upjohn merged with Mylan, and it inherited this patch not by inventing it, but by accumulation, the way such firms accumulate everything. The pipeline molecule originated with a smaller developer and traveled through partnership structures to the balance sheet of a company whose core competence is not discovery, but global registration, manufacturing, and the patient, low-margin discipline of selling established medicines at scale. There is a certain irony in the pattern, and it repeats across the category. When innovation does arrive in contraception, it tends to arrive through the side door. A generic giant's business development team, an acquisition, a 505B2 application leaning on another company's old data, rather than through the front door of the industry's research engines, which exited the field after the litigation era and never came back. The venture-backed women's health wave of the 2020s has produced apps, clinics, and direct-to-consumer pills, but the fundamental chemistry on the pharmacy shelf still moves at the pace of the largest, slowest, most litigation-scarred players. The patch's approval is thus two stories at once: evidence that the category can be revisited at all, and a reminder that the revisiting is being done by the industry's consolidators rather than its inventors. The 505(b)(2) pathway itself is half the explanation for why this product exists at all, and it deserves a plain explanation. A full new drug application requires the applicant to generate all its own safety and efficacy data, a decade and several hundred million dollars. The 505(b)(2) hybrid lets an applicant rely on the agency's prior findings of safety and effectiveness for an already approved drug, supplementing them only with the new data needed to support what has changed. Here, the lower dose, the new delivery profile, the adhesion performance. It is the pathway of incremental engineering. A different route, a different rate, a different dose of a molecule the agency already trusts, and it collapses both the cost and the timeline of entry by an order of magnitude. Its existence is a quiet policy choice. The United States has decided, in effect, that improvements to existing medicines deserve a cheaper door than new medicines. In a litigation-scarred category, that cheaper door is not a shortcut. It is the only door anyone will walk through. Section 4. The original angle. BMI 30 as the new front line. Here is the detail the coverage will argue about for years, and it is on the label. The approval is restricted to women with a body mass index under 30. The restriction is scientifically defensible. The pivotal trial was not powered to demonstrate efficacy above that threshold, and adiposity is known to affect hormonal pharmacokinetics. But its consequences land in the middle of the most uncomfortable intersection in American medicine. More than half of American women of reproductive age have a BMI over 30. The method best suited to solving contraception's adherence problem is, on its label, unavailable to the majority of the women who need it most. Disproportionately low-income women. Disproportionately women of color. Disproportionately the populations with the highest rates of unintended pregnancy. The industry's honest response is that the restriction is not a judgment, but a data boundary, and the fix is another trial. The cynic's response is that the boundary was drawn where it was because running the larger, heavier, messier trial costs more than launching with a clean label. Both are true, and the tension between them is the future of the category. Will the post-approval studies extend the label to the population that was excluded? Or will the exclusion calcify into the product's permanent shape, the way contraindications from the 2000s calcified into a decade of silence? The label is the product. Whatever the studies show, the answer will be written there. What makes the BMI 30 line genuinely novel, rather than just another exclusion, is that it collides with the direction the rest of medicine is moving. The newer generation of obesity therapeutics is pulling the population's average weight down for the first time in a generation, and every clinical trialist is quietly recalculating what the average patient will look like in 5 years. A contraceptive label frozen at BMI 30 is a snapshot of the population that no longer exists. The company that first runs the trial in the population as it actually is, heavier, more diverse, more representative of the unintended pregnancy statistics, will not just win a label expansion. It will expose how dated the exclusionary design of the last contraceptive era really was. The label is the product, and the product is now visibly out of date. What to look for next? The first signal is the launch itself. Pricing, insurance coverage, and whether the weekly format is positioned as premium, because a contraceptive's real-world success in America is determined at the pharmacy counter, not the clinic. The second is the label's evolution. Watch for post-marketing commitments and any trial in women with higher BMI, which is the difference between a niche product and a category-defining one. The third is competition. The approval reopens the category, and other firms with dormant transdermal programs will read it as the all clear. So expect filings, not just one. The fourth is political. Contraceptive coverage mandates remain contested territory, and a new branded entrant during a coverage fight is either a proof point or a target, depending on the year. The over-the-counter horizon is the fifth signal, and it may be the most consequential of all. The pill's own switch to non-prescription status, a milestone the category waited 6 decades for, rewired the assumptions about who can access contraception without a clinic visit. A patch is, on its face, an even better over-the-counter candidate than a pill. The dosing errors that self-administration invites are largely designed out. The failure mode is visible and correctable, and the weekly rhythm needs no daily discipline. But the prescription label and the BMI 30 limit written into it is the regulatory moat that must be crossed first. And the company's incentives are ambivalent. Prescription status means prescriber-driven reimbursement, while an over-the-counter switch trades insurance economics for shelf access. Whether the patch follows the pill to the open shelf and how fast will say more about the category's future than the approval itself does. Section 6. The broader pattern and open question. The broad pattern is that women's health innovation moves in decades-long cycles, punctuated by litigation, and the gaps between the cycles are longer than the products themselves. The pill's 60s, the NuvaRing's 2000s, the patch's 220s, each burst of progress followed by a withdrawal that lasts until the lawyers retire and the market forgets. The forgetting is now apparently sufficient. What is different this time is not the science, which is incremental, but the plumbing. Telehealth prescribing, direct-to-consumer pharmacies, and an approval pathway that lets a consolidator lean on old data instead of betting new research money. The category may finally have found a way to innovate at the speed of its slowest participants, which is to say, slowly. There is a second pattern, and it is about who bears the cost of the gaps. Between product cycles, women did not stop needing contraception. They aged into a frozen menu, and the missing decades of innovation were paid for in unintended pregnancies, in method dissatisfaction, in abortions and births that a functioning innovation market might have offered better options for. By the population with the least say in the industry's risk calculus. The next gap, wherever it opens, will be paid for the same way. Which leaves the open question. Is this approval the first trickle of a reopening category, or a single stone rolled uphill by one consolidator with a tolerance for old risk? The patch is approved. The label is printed. 20 years of silence ends with a 4-page label that half the country's women cannot read as theirs. And whether the next chapter closes that gap or preserves it is the story to watch. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create fiction, nonfiction, and turn your documents into audio, all stored in one place with a single subscription. Plus, get instant access to thousands of audiobooks and deep dive investigations. Learn more today at myaudiobooks.ai. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.